Okay, good evening, everyone. Parshas Metzaira, Tavshanayin Tes. We'll start with the Parsha, and then we'll see how far we go with that, and then we'll talk about some Pesach. So, Vayidaber, page 620, Bina Parshas Metzaira, Perek Yidal Pasuk Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem El Meisha Lemar. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Zayis Tiyataras HaMetzaira B'yem Taharasai. This shall be the law of the Metzaira, the person stricken with Saras, on the day that he becomes pure. He shall be brought to the Kohen. So on these words, this is the law of the Metzaira, there is a Medrash. And the Medrash starts like this. It's a famous Medrash. Maiseh bereichel echad shoyemachzer ba'yaris. A story about a peddler used to travel around cities shoyusmuchas litzipuri that were near a city called Sipuri. And this peddler would announce and say, "Man by the mizman samachayim, who wants to buy a potion for life? Or we call it an elixir. Elixir, is that the right word? Elixir. All right, let's call it a potion for life." Everybody came and started gathering around and pushing. Rabbi Yane Abba Yosef upasha b'tor kolinei. Rabbi Yane was sitting. He was studying. He heard this person announcing, "Who wants this potion for life?" Come up here, sell it to me. Omar Le, the peddler said to Rav Yanai, "Lav ansarach levlad chavasach. You don't need it." Atrachale, but he kept pressuring him. Selik lagabe, so he came up to him. Haytzilai sefer Tehillim. The peddler took out a book of Tehillim. Hemalei Pasuk and showed him a verse. Mi ha'ish ha'chavetz chayim. Who is the one who wants life? Maksiv basrei. What does the Pasuk and Talmud say right after that? The tzar l'shein chameira. Guard your tongue from evil. Sumer revasei toiv. Straight, go away from evil and do good. So there it is. What's the potion? What the Pasuk says. Mi ha'ish ha'chavetz chayim. Who is the person who wants life? Guard your tongue from evil. That's the potion for life. Amar Rabbi Yanai, Av Shlomi Machriz Vayomer. Rabbi Yanai said, Shlomi HaMelech also announced this when he said, Shomer Pivu L'Shoinai, one who guards his mouth and his tongue, Shomer Mitzaras Navshe, guards his soul from suffering. Amar Rabbi Yanai said, Kol Yomai Ha'yisi Kerei HaPasek Azel. All my life I read this verse, V'Yisi Yadei Heichan Hupashit, and I didn't know how to interpret it. Until this peddler came and let it be known. Who is the one who wants life? The person who is guards his tongue from evil. Therefore, Moshe was warning the Jewish people and said, this shall be the law of the Metzaira. This person stricken with Saras is called the Metzaira. This is the law. This is the law of a person who has spread an evil name about someone else. So here we have this story about a peddler who was going around and telling people, "Who wants a potion of life?" And they all came running. And what did he do? He opened up a Tehillim and he showed him a pasuk. That's what he did. And when Rabbi Yanai saw this, experienced this, Rabbi Yanai said, "Oh, now I know what the Pasuk is saying. Now I know what the Pasuk means." So the obvious question is, Rabbi Yanai knew Tanakh. And anybody who reads the Pasuk, it says it. Mi shachavetz chayim, who is the person who wants life? Ayiv lamiris taiv, love is ace to see good. Netzal Hashem chameira, guard your tongue from evil. It's right there in the Pasuk. There's no big chiddush here. If the peddler is trying to do something shticky, they get people to stop being Lashon Hara. All right, so he gets up and he says, who wants a potion for life? And everybody comes running and he says, don't speak Lashon Hara. Okay, but Rabbi Yanai said, I never understood this pasuk until now. It's pasuk pshat. It's what it says.
And that's what peddler thought, that he doesn't need it.
Excuse me?
And that's what peddler thought that.
Okay, but afterwards he said, the peddler said before you don't need it, but afterwards said now he said, now I know what the pasuk means. What was he missing before? Okay, so I'm going to share with you two explanations to this. So my friend, in his Sefer on the Parsha, so he says that the peddler's lesson was the following. The peddler's novelty, his chiddush, was the following. So people think that the way to refrain from speaking Lashon Hara is to refrain from speaking altogether. You don't want to speak Lashon Hara, don't talk. If I'm going to talk, probably going to speak Lashon Hara. That is what people think. Those who knew the Chafetz Chaim close up knew that the Chafetz Chaim, who we know, who wrote the book on the laws of Lashon Hara, that the Chafetz Chaim disproved that idea, because the Chafetz Chaim was constantly speaking to people, always, a whole day long. That's what he was doing, speaking to people, dealing with people, answering people's problems, community's problems. He spoke all the time, but he didn't speak any Lashon Hara. So that idea, the Chafetz Chaim disproved through his own actions. But this is what people tend to think. Rabbi Yannai also knew this pasuk. You know what the pasuk said? But he also was leaning, at least, towards the idea that there's only one way you're really going to stop speaking Lashon Hara, and that is to refrain from speaking. But then he met this peddler. Now, peddlers were real talkers. Because part of being a peddler was that you hawked your wares and you schmoozed it up with the customers. And it seems that typical peddlers were known for spreading gossip. You wanted to know a good story about something that happened in a different town, the peddler came and let you know. And I guess as a reward for a good story, you went in and bought his wares. But whatever it may be, the peddlers, they were known for being the people who were big talkers. It was part of their business. It was part of getting their customers. They talked. They talked about their wares. They hawked their wares. But it also seems that they also, in order to kind of spice things up and get people interested, they always had a good, juicy story to tell about other people that they met in other places that they were. As a matter of fact, when the Torah talks about the prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara, the Torah does not say, Loi sedaber Lashon Hara. It doesn't say, don't speak Lashon Hara. It says, Loi seylech Rachel. Don't go peddling stories. It uses the word peddle, as don't be a peddler, to talk about speaking Lashon Hara. You see how at a certain point of time, being a peddler and speaking Lashon Hara was one and the same. Okay? So that's what typical peddlers were. It was part of their business to speak Lashon Hara. Now, here you have a peddler. He's a peddler. He's got to talk. He's got to schmooze. He's got to get the customers involved. And he's the one who's saying not to speak Lashon Hara. How could he do that? How is he going to be able to be a peddler and not speak Lashon Hara? So the answer the peddler was trying to say was that, no, you could do that. You can do both. You could talk and not speak Lashon Hara. That's what you're supposed to do. Basically, something that Rabbi Yannai wasn't so sure about, he now saw it right in front of him. He saw a talker who had to talk. He always talked, otherwise he couldn't make a living, but he didn't speak Lashon Hara.
And he attracted interest. Yeah.
And that was a new insight. The new insight to the pasuk was, of course, you want to be able to have life. Speaking Lashon Hara destroys life. But how am I not going to speak Lashon Hara? The assumption is, I'll really have to stop talking. The peddler said, no, you don't have to. You don't have to. A person can do it. The peddler said, you can do it. You can speak, and you can speak a lot, and you can still speak Kevel Lashon Hara. A person can do it. And when Rabbi Yannai saw that he could do it, a peddler could do it, that's when Rabbi Yannai understood that it's within everybody's ability to go ahead. It's within everybody's ability to be this way. They don't have to remain silent. They can talk. At the same time, they can heed the laws of Lashon Hara and speak properly.
Not only he can talk, right? He can actually make a living, right?
Right.
When other peddlers do the Lashon Hara.
Right, right.
He can actually make
right.
a living.
The point is that where his living was, where the typical way of making a living was speaking Lashon Hara, he was trying to say, I can talk, I can make a living, and I won't speak Lashon Hara. That's very good, that's right. Mm-hmm. Now, I would just add to this that, you know, so here you have this peddler. Clearly, it wasn't random that, you know, he's, you know, teaching about Lashon Hara. You know, but all, like, he does two things. He's a peddler and he speaks Lashon Hara. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't random that he was speaking Lashon Hara. Rather, he knew that people were coming, when he came to town as a peddler, right, people were coming to hear some juicy gossip. They came to hear some juicy gossip. And therefore, he was actually best well equipped to really give them a strong lesson in Lashon Hara, that when they're coming expecting your Lashon Hara, here's the guy, the kind of guy who typically makes his living off of Lashon Hara, and he says, don't speak Lashon Hara. And I'm a peddler. I'm a peddler, and I don't speak Lashon Hara. And if I don't speak Lashon Hara, then you shouldn't speak Lashon Hara either. So it wasn't a random thing. It really was something that he knew he had the ability to really impress upon people because of who he was and what he did. Okay.
We still have that, right? We have news tied into advertisement of products.
Okay.
So that's exactly the same thing.
Okay.
They come for peddler and they click and buy something.
Okay. Okay. So that's how Refrand explains this medrash. Yaakov Kamenetsky explains a little bit, has another approach. Rabbi Yaakov's approach is that this man was a peddler. You know what he peddled? Or at least some of the things he peddled? Svarim. He assumes that he peddled spices. I'm not sure where that comes from. Gabrichel, I guess, has to do with something like that. But he also says, this peddler, he peddled Svarim. He did two things. Whatever it was, some other thing, and Svarim. Okay? So now, how did he advertise his Svarim? How did he get people to come and buy Svarim? When I mean Svarim, I don't mean comic books. I mean Torah books. Okay? And so how did he get them to become interested in buying the Svarim? He made an announcement. Who wants life? Who wants life? So when they came, okay, when they came, right, and they wanted to hear about life, right, about who wants life, what did he do? He opened up a Tehillim, and he showed them, Netzal Hashem Chameira, guard your tongue from evil, and Miyash Chametz Chaim, who wants life, Netzal Hashem Chameira, guard your tongue from evil. Now, Yaakov points out, and again, we have. He's also trying to explain. Okay, what was the chiddush here? What was Rabbi Yanai again? Was impressed here. First of all, the peddler said to him, "You don't need it." And the Rabbi Yanai said, "From this peddler, I learned a new insight." So Rabbi Yanai has to now work toward. That's what we're trying to work towards. So Rabbi Yanai points out that when the peddler, at least in the medrash, the wording of the medrash, when the peddler is making this announcement, he doesn't say "man boy chai," who wants life. There's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah that has a similar story, not with a peddler, but with a Rav, who also made an announcement, a similar announcement. But his announcement was, Man Boy Chai, who wants life? Here the wording is, Man Boy Samad Chai, who wants an elixir for life? Who wants a potion for life? So Yaakov says, life itself, not speaking Lashon Hara, is life itself. That's not an elixir for life. Not speaking Lashon Hara is life itself. You want to have life, you want to live life, you don't speak Lashon Hara. If you speak Lashon Hara, you don't have life. So, not speaking Lashon Hara itself is life. But the potion for life, what is it that you can take, so to speak? What is it that you can take that's going to help you not speak Lashon Hara? What can you take to give you the strength, the ability not to speak Lashon Hara? You know what the answer to that is? Svarim. Learning Torah. Learning Torah is what's going to stop you from speaking Lashon Hara. And Rabbi Yanker brings actually a very interesting medrash. At the he brings a medrash. The way you know, this sefer by Rabbi Yanker Kamenetsky is not something he specifically wrote. It was written by his grandson. Different classes that he gave and different notes that he had. So this piece is actually from a drasha, from a talk that he gave. So he brings out a medrash that says like this. Rabbi Yanker brings out a medrash. Shamu lo Yisrael Kadosh Baruch Hu. The Jewish people said to Hashem, Ribbono Shel Olam, His heart to Eisano kama v'kama mitzvahs. You gave us many mitzvahs. Hayinu lois asei atluyim b'lashon. Many of them are dependent on our mouth. Ten lo machsim lafinu. We need something to keep our mouth closed. That we shouldn't say the wrong things. Omar lehem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to them, what do you mean? I gave you my Torah. Iskuba, study it. And that will stop you from speaking Lashon Hara, Rechilas, and lies. On the bottom, in the footnote, his grandson who put this together says he never found an actual medrash or saying of Chazal that phrases it like this, but he has a yalkut. The yalkut says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Bo'ilam HaZeh, in this world, Al-Yedei Shisim B'teinim HaDivrei Torah, because you didn't study Torah, HaYisim HaSichim B'Bnei Adam, you spoke about other people. You didn't study Torah, what'd you do? You talked about other people. Aval La'asad Lavay, in the future, Atem L'meidim Torah Mipi, I'll teach you Torah, V'animar B'lachem Shalom, and I will give you peace. So I'm not sure what that in the future part is exactly, but you see that Svedish says the same idea. If you'd be studying Torah, you wouldn't be speaking Lashon Hara. So that is what Yankov learns here was the Samad Chayim, the potion for life, the potion to keep you from speaking Lashon Hara, which is something that you must have for life. If you speak Lashon Hara, you're missing life. The potion to get there are the Svarim, it's the Torah study. And therefore, when Rav Yanai said, hey, come up here, I want the potion, the peddler said, you don't need it.
Yeah, the question is, why you don't need it.
You don't need it. You're studying Torah. Rav Yanai didn't know what he meant. But Rav Yanai heard it. He says, you know, I'm interested. What is this? So he said, you don't need it. But he didn't get what he meant until he walked in and he opened up the Tehillim and he showed him, right? It says, if you want life, look right here. Basically, what he was trying now again. Now, in essence, it's anything in Torah, it seems, is going to help you not speak Lashon Hara. Torah study in general is going to help you not speak Lashon Hara. But when he went ahead and he didn't say the potion of life. He didn't like, you know, here's the potion of life. Just hand him a sefer. He opened up this pasuk about the Nesalu Shayim Chameira, guard your tongue from evil. Right? He opened up the pasuk that said, who wants life? Guard your tongue from evil. So it's like, he gave him the sefer to say, you know, studying a sefer is what's going to give you that, is going to be the potion for life. The part of Torah that he chose to show him was a part that spoke about life. Who wants life? You know, person who guards his tongue. Well, that was like just a very clear example of how studying Torah gives you life. Because when you study Torah and you study this pasuk, you gain that understanding. But it wasn't so much about Lashon Hara per se, or actually it was, because again, he understood that Lashon Hara, not speaking Lashon Hara, is going to give you life. But what's going to be the potion for life? What's going to be the potion that's going to help you not speak Lashon Hara? The answer to that is Torah study, right? Torah study is going to help you. It's going to help you for that. And where in the Torah do you find that clearly? In this pasuk. His advertising was who wants a potion for life? Well, what he meant to say is study Torah. But where in Torah? Where can you study Torah? Where it says straight out where you can get life from? The answer is, he gave him that pasuk that says the Tzadosh and Chameira. That's like the most direct way of supporting his advertising, where the Torah actually says to have life. But that's just an example of how studying Torah is going to help you not speak Lashon Hara. Now, Remankov doesn't say this, but what is it about Torah study that we say is that sam? What is it about Torah study that is that potion to help you not speak Lashon Hara? What does Torah study do for you that it helps you not to speak Lashon Hara? So, on the most basic level, the Torah teaches you the basics of what you may say and what you may not say. The Torah teaches you the prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara. The Torah we have from different sources and different laws, from Torah Shebaal Peh, what constitutes Lashon Hara, what doesn't constitute Lashon Hara. And then you have Psukim and Midrashim and other parts of the Torah that speak about the greatness of not speaking Lashon Hara and the severity of speaking Lashon Hara. So step number one, the first step of how Torah becomes that potion to help you not to speak Lashon Hara, are the parts of Torah that are very clear that tell you. You know, number one, you got a pasuk that tells you you learn from the Torah that life comes from guarding your tongue. That's one of the basic things that you get from studying Torah. You get the basics of the severity of speaking Lashon Hara, the importance of not speaking Lashon Hara, and the laws. That's step number one. Step number two comes from the fact that there is a concept that just studying the laws of something makes an impression upon you and helps you not, and it helps you keep those laws. Meaning, when you study laws, now you have the understanding of what to do and not to do. Otherwise, you just don't even know what to do or what not to do. But there is also something, I think Reb Shaul Salanter says this, that studying the laws itself, like makes an impression on your neshama, that itself helps you keep the laws. Just the studying of it helps. So again, just the studying of the laws of Lashon Hara is going to help. And then I think on another level, it's that Torah study sanctifies your mouth. Makes your mouth holy. And a holy mouth cannot tolerate Lashon Hara that defiles the mouth. So learning to hold the point of Rabbi Yankov's point here is that the lesson of the peddler was is that the Sama Chayim, the potion for life, the Pasuk says, you want life? Guard your tongue from evil. Guard your tongue from evil. That the Pasuk says. That's straight out. Life comes from not speaking Lashon Hara. But what that really means is if you want to have life, you don't speak Lashon Hara. Life itself is dependent on that. What the peddler was now going ahead and teaching was, what's the potion for life? What's going to be the potion? What can you do to help you not speak Lashon Hara? And that the answer was, he took out a sefer, and he showed everyone, you know what's going to help you? What's going to give you life? Studying Torah. And the example that he gave was the example that itself said, who wants life? What's going to give you life? What's going to help you not speak Lashon Hara? A sefer, studying Torah. And here's your prime example. Your prime example is studying the pasuk that says, who wants life? Guard your tongue from evil. That's the basic form. But then after that, of course, it does expand to other segments, to other facets of studying Torah that also will help you, will be that potion to help you not speak Lashon Hara. Now, Rabbi Yaakov ties this into Pesach. Because he mentions here the fact that we know that Lashon Hara played a part in the fact the Jewish people were enslaved. What's the connection? So the connection is because there is a medrash that says, Rashi actually brings this down in Parsha Shmois. So in Parsha Shmois, Moshe goes out to see his brethren who were enslaved. He sees an Egyptian man beating a Hebrew slave. He kills the Egyptian man. The next day there are two Jewish slaves fighting. He goes over and rebukes one. And he said, the brethren rebuked says, he's going to kill me like he killed the Egyptian, which Moshe understood that means that he's going to go and he's going to inform on him. So Rashi comments that when Moshe Rabbeinu heard that coming from that person's mouth, when Moshe Rabbeinu realized that that person was going to inform on him, that Moshe Rabbeinu now got an answer to a question. Moshe Rabbeinu wondered, what was it about the Jewish people that they were suffering so much? What did they do? What's there within them that's causing them to be enslaved so terribly? Now, Moshe Rabbeinu says, now I see what it is. If they're ready to inform on another person, then that means that there's something very corrupt in their character, and that's why they're being punished. Now, you can ask, I would ask, every time I see this Rashi, okay, so because one guy is going to inform, that means everybody else is speaking Lashon Hara, and that's why everybody else is enslaved?
But also inform is much stronger.
That's right. And informing is much stronger than just regular Lashon Hara, right? But it seems that it's not just Rabbi Yaakov who does it. There's a lot of commentaries that they equate Lashon Hara with this event. And I think your question is very good. Being malish and informing is much worse than that. And again, it was only two people doing it. Why is that a sign of everybody else? But I think the answer is because we don't work in a vacuum. We don't work in a vacuum. If you could have somebody who's ready to inform, that just doesn't happen on its own. That means that it's like a trickle-up effect, in the sense that if there's people who are generally speaking against each other, that now creates, so to speak, the atmosphere that kind of speaking against each other could even lead to another Jew informing about another Jew. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu said, now I see what's wrong. Now, Rabbi Yankov says, we see that before the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, that they rectified this. Where do we see that from? So this is the way he says it. It's very interesting. Moshe Rabbeinu told the Jewish people, and told the Jewish people before they left, that they're going to get, that they should go ahead and they should go to their Egyptian neighbors and borrow gold and silver. And we know that already with Makas Choshech, right? They went searching around everything. So there was a significant, there was a decent amount of time that they knew they were going to ask for the gold and silver from everyone before they actually left. It's not like the last minute he said to them, go around and ask. It wasn't a last minute thing. They were about beforehand. So there was already this plan to empty everything out. Okay? The Jewish people knew about it, and none of them went and told anybody else about it.
Self-interest,
yeah. They didn't tell anybody about it. Well, if you had an informer, right? If you had an informer around, right? If this problem informant was still around, mm-hmm. He wants to argue, then why wasn't there somebody who went over to the Egyptians and let them know what the plan is if this problem was still there? So he uses this as a proof that, you see, they rectified it. Something to think about. Something to think about. But that's how he says it. He says they knew about it, and nobody told the Egyptians about it. And if this informing problem was still present, right, then one would think that there'd be somebody there that would do that. And therefore, he says, you see that they rectified it, and that's why now they were able to be redeemed. Okay, that's the parasha. Let's talk about some Pesach now. Talk about some Pesach. Okay. Now, this past Shabbos was Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh Nissan, it was Parshas HaChodesh, where we read it's either the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nissan or the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nissan. We read how before the Jewish people left, before Makas Becheres, Hashem told the Jewish people, HaChodesh Hazel Lachem Reish Chodeshim. This month of Nisan is the first of all months. And then he told them the laws of the Korban Pesach and of the holiday of Pesach. Now, Rashi points out that when Moshe Rabbeinu said to them, this is the first of all months, this is where the simple explanation is the month of Nisan is always counted as month one, as the first month, which is in the Torah. The month of Nisan is always counted as the first month, and everything follows that. Rashi also brings down that what Hashem was giving to when Hashem told Moshe, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem Reish Chodashim, that it was actually giving Moshe the mitzvah of establishing the new month by the new moon. Right? That is how the Jewish month is established, by the reappearance of the moon. And when Moshe was told, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem, this month is for you, it wasn't just HaChodesh, this month, but HaChodesh, this new moon. Hashem pointed to Moshe the new moon. This new moon is a sign of the new month. This is where, and what this means is the Jewish people were told that when you're going to establish a new, when you establish a month, you establish it by the sighting of the new moon. And the question is, we can understand why now they're being told about the Korban Pesach, they have to fulfill it. Why do they need to know now about how to establish Reish Chodesh with the new moon? Why is that so important now? Why of all things is that being mentioned now? So, many Mepharshim deal with this. So, the explanation I want to share with you is the following. This is based on the writings of Mepharsh. Now, in order to understand, we have to go back a little bit and think about this whole establishing of the month on the new, based on the new moon. What that means was that there was a time, for many years in the history of the Jewish people, that the new moon, with the new month was established by witnesses who saw the new moon appear, would go to Yerushalayim and testify to the fact that they saw the new moon. They would be interrogated, and if everything worked out, they would pronounce, we have a new moon, we have a new month. Now, that practice stopped a long time ago. We have an established calendar. It was established, I don't know the exact number, over 1,000 years ago. It was established. It can be mathematically calculated. And the Chachamim did that. So the question is, if we know, right, by calculation, when the new moon is supposed to come, so why did the Torah make us do this with the witnesses? Why do we have to go through the whole thing with the witnesses? And what if the witnesses come too late? You have to push it off a day. You know? And that's why nowadays holidays only fall out in certain ways, because we're going by the calculation. If you go by witnesses, it doesn't work that way, because it's all about the witnesses. And if the witnesses for some reason come a little bit late or whatever happens, it's the new month starts later. Forget about the calculation. It's just going to start later. Why did the Torah, if we're able to calculate, why did the Torah want that we should establish this through witnesses? We don't need the whole thing. We make a calculation, we know it. Another thing is that it's important to keep in mind that this whole mitzvah of establishing the new moon based on the new moon really kept the Jewish people focused on the moon. Because as soon as the moon was disappeared, they're already waiting when it's going to come out. As soon as it came out, there was this mad dash through Yerushalayim from anybody who saw it. Anybody who saw it went running through Yerushalayim. As a matter of fact, there's even circumstances they could desecrate Shabbos get through Yerushalayim. And when they got through Yerushalayim, okay, so there could be many witnesses who came, and they spoke to every one of them. Because if they didn't speak to every one of them, then people would say, why should I bother going? They spoke to every one of them, and people were now waiting. Okay, when is it going to be? When's the official announcement going to be that it's Reish Chodesh? There was a tremendous amount of focus on this. And Rav Hirsch says that the focus of on the moon was carries a message that the Rebbeinu Shalom wanted the Jewish people to hear as they were becoming a nation, and that we should, for all generations following, keep heed that lesson. And the lesson of the new moon is exactly what we call it. We call it a new moon. That means that we call it a new moon. The word for month in Hebrew is chodesh. That's related to the word chadash, new. When we say Kiddush Lavana, the bracha over the new moon, we call it mechadash chadashim. Hashem makes new months. The idea of newness is always related to the emergence of the moon from its darkness. So the moon emerges from its darkness and starts again. The Jewish people were now emerging from the darkness of Mitzrayim, the darkness of Egypt, and they were becoming a new nation. Just as the moon emerges from darkness and becomes the new moon, and becomes a new month, so too the Jewish people were now emerging from the darkness of Mitzrayim. The darkness of Mitzrayim being its immorality, its decadence. Rav Hirsch uses a term, he calls it religious stagnation. And this is what the Jewish people were emerging from. The lesson of the moon is that the moon is constantly emerging from darkness and renewing itself. It's constantly doing that. You are doing that now. You're emerging from darkness and becoming a new nation. And always remember the lesson of the moon, that you can also emerge anew from darkness whenever it happens. Of course, we try not to sink in darkness. It's inevitable. But the lesson of the moon is, the same way the moon constantly reemerges from darkness, you too, the Jewish people, you could also emerge from darkness. And that was the lesson he wanted them to know. He wanted them to look at the moon. He wanted us to be focused on the moon. Focus on this thing in the sky that shines bright. It gets swallowed up in darkness, but it comes out again. It does it all the time. It's constantly emerging from the darkness, and it's a new moon. You too, Jewish people, you are emerging from the darkness of Egypt. That darkness of Egypt is gonna follow you in all generations. But you too can constantly re-emerge from that darkness and renew yourselves. Which means that the first lesson of the Jewish people was, you can change. You can change. Don't think that you're stuck in darkness. You can emerge from darkness and you can change. And even if it happens over and over and over again, you can change. Each time you slip, each time you fall, each time you get stuck in darkness, you get stuck in religious stagnation, you can emerge from that darkness. Just as the moon constantly emerges, you can also emerge. You can change. And bringing out this idea, Rabbi Frantz has two stories, that two contrasting stories about people who reacted differently to change. Perhaps I've used this story in the past here. So he tells one story about Rabbi Zev Leff, who's actually a Rebbe now in Eretz Yisrael. He used to be a Rebbe in Miami Beach. And there was one night that he was giving a class in Hilchah and the laws of Shabbos between Mincha and Ma'ariv, and he was talking about the laws of Borer. Borer means that if you're going to separate food, you're going to separate something that you want from that you don't want in food, there's laws how you do that. You got to take the good from the bad. You can't take the bad from the good. You got to take what you want from what you don't want, not what you don't. You have to take what you want from what you don't want, not what you don't want from what you do want. It's those laws of Borer, separating, sorting. So that's what he was teaching between Mincha and Ma'ariv. And there was one person who came from Ma'ariv. He had yard site. He went to Daven for the Amud. And unfortunately, he came too early, and he was stuck listening to the rabbi's drasha, Rabbi Shia. And he heard the rabbi talking about Borer. When you eat a piece of fish, you got to take the bones from the fish, you got to take the fish from the bones, not the bones from the fish, giving different examples of this. And after Ma'ariv, the man comes over to Rabbi Leff and he says, you know, this Borer stuff you were talking about, it can't be true. It can't be true. So Rabbi Leff says to him, why? So the man says, look, I've kept Shabbos my whole life. My father kept Shabbos his whole life. My grandfather kept Shabbos his whole life. And we never heard of anything about Borer. We never heard anything about this kind of thing. It must be some kind of a community. In some place, it must be a custom of some communities, but it can't be halacha. It's hard to like say to yourself, wow, you know, all these generations of people who kept Shabbos and now they were doing something wrong. It's hard to admit to that. But being willing to change means you're willing to change. So he says, see, the Rabbi Fran says, took a little different story. He says, a woman in Houston, she keeps Shabbos, best of her knowledge, she keeps kosher home. She invites a neighbor for a Friday night meal. The guest brings a nice serving tray. So the hostess says, wow, we can use this tray tonight to serve the food. The guest says, no, it wasn't toiveled. It wasn't immersed in the mikveh. And the hostess says, toiveled? She says, yeah, you know, that before you use your pots and pans, your dishes, you got to toivel them. She goes, I don't know, my mother never told me about that. Okay, well, then I guess we won't be able to use this serving dish. But then the guest says, wait a minute, you never toiveled your dishes? And she goes, no. What are we going to do? He says, do you have disposable dishes? She goes, sure. Okay, well, you need disposable dishes. But wait a minute. What about all the pots and the pans that have the food? They weren't toiveled either. You have aluminum pans? Yeah. Half an hour before Shabbos, all the food gets transferred out of the pots and pans into aluminum pans. And Shabbos, they ate on disposable dishes and cutlery. Here you have another story, right? She didn't know. Again, my mother never told me. But she was told. She accepted. She was willing to change. There's a big difference when a person is willing to change, when a person is not willing to change. And that was the lesson to the Jewish people. Look at the moon. Look at the moon and know that no matter how much darkness you may be submerged in, you can always emerge from it. You can always come out of that darkness. And no matter how many times you may fall or how many times you may slip up, you can always emerge from darkness and you can always make yourself new.
Kosher food question.
So, yeah. Do we have to? It's still kosher, the food.
Right.
Food's still kosher.
Even though
you used the non-toiveled pots and pans, it does not make the food not kosher.
Wow.
You're just not supposed to use those things, but it does not make them not kosher. Okay. Yeah, that's the obvious question that gets asked.
I didn't
asked.
Even ask.
That, it's too. Okay. It's okay. But that that's the halach. It doesn't affect the food. Okay. So that was the lesson, one of the first lessons that were given to the Jewish people. Now, the next thing that I want to share with you, it's a very touching story. It's a story that involved who was known as the Blujava Rebbe. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Spira. And the Blujava Rebbe was a survivor of the war. He went through many ghettos and concentration camps and labor camps, and he survived them all. He lost his entire family, but he survived. And the story goes that in one slave labor camp, the Rebbe developed a civil relationship with the commandant. And a few weeks before Pesach, he decided to take a chance. And he asked the commandant permission to make matzah for Pesach. and he asked for some flour, and that the prisoners agreed to have the flour for the matzah subtracted from the already meager food rations that they had in order to eat matzah on Pesach. And for some reason, miraculously, the commandant agreed. He agreed. So they put together a makeshift oven, and after a full day of backbreaking labor, a few Jews baked small portions of matzah in this oven. And it went on for a couple of days until the commandant destroyed the oven in a fit of anger. That was the end of the matzah making. So now when Pesach came, there clearly was not enough matzah for everyone in this group who was participating. So the Rebbe and other leaders of this group decided that the adults would receive a piece of matzah. The children, who were not obligated from the Torah in the mitzvah of matzah, they wouldn't get matzah. There was a woman there. This woman had lost her husband, she lost her married sister, and she managed to hold on to her two sons and two nephews, who she kept alive until after the war. Not only that, this woman, I think, if I remember correctly, she sold some of her food rations to buy a Tanakh, with translation, so she could teach the boys Tanakh. That's the kind of woman she was. She protested, and she said, no. She said, the children are our future. They are the ones who will rebuild the Jewish nation. They must receive a piece of matzah. They're our future. They must receive a piece of matzah. And the Rebbe agreed. The Rebbe agreed. And actually, after the war, the Rebbe married this woman. Now, you know, so, you know, when I hear this story, the story is like, well, you know, they're our future, they have to participate in the mitzvah. But there could have also been a deeper message in this idea that those children have to eat matzah. And that is that there is a famous question that's asked. The Jewish people were enslaved, they were downtrodden, they were suffering. Spiritually, they felt at a 49th level of Tumah. And it was from that state of being that they became Hashem's people to receive the Torah. Why did they have to become the nation of Hashem from this situation, in this state? In this state of lowliness, this was the state that they became the Jewish people from. Was it random? Was it random that they really Hashem wanted them to straighten out, but he couldn't wait any longer? I mean, we do say the Bayit HaMatzah, he couldn't wait any longer, right? But is that what it's about? That they really shouldn't have been the new nation at this point of time, but there was no chance. But if waited any longer, there was no chance, and therefore he took them out and made them his nation. That doesn't seem to be how many of the commentaries assume. They assume that even if you say matzah is about Hashem rushing us out, but again, rushing us out was about allowing us, if he didn't rush us out, we couldn't become his nation. But the fact that we became the nation of Hashem to receive the Torah, specifically in this kind of being, in this state of being, had a very specific reason for it. And the reason is because Hashem was teaching the Jewish people, and perhaps the world, that the Jewish people would become a nation under circumstances that most people wouldn't be able to survive. Most people in that kind, or every nation that would find them that could find themselves in a similar situation where the Jewish people were, became extinct. They didn't survive. The Jewish people, on the other hand, became a nation, emerged a nation out of a situation that no one else would be able to survive. It was really about the fact that we became the Jewish nation specifically out of this kind of situation that we're in as slaves and downtrodden, was actually to bring to show that we're not dependent. Our survival isn't dependent on what other nations need to survive. We have an eternity because we're Hashem's people. And we became a nation and we exist as a nation outside of the norms of what a nation needs to be able to become a nation or to survive being a nation. That was the lesson of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That we exist and we survive and we are eternal because we are not dependent on the factors that other people need to survive. We are chosen as Hashem's people, we are chosen as Hashem's children, and because of that we are eternal. We don't need to survive. We do survive against all odds. Against all odds and factors that would destroy another nation, we still survive. That's what we emerged from, and that is what we survive as for all generations. Therefore, perhaps the idea of these children eating matzah was because she wanted the future of the Jewish people to taste freedom while still in slavery. While they were in slavery, she wanted them to taste matzah because matzah is about freedom. She wanted them to taste freedom in slavery because she wanted them to realize that no matter what situation the Jewish people will be in, they will be redeemed. They will survive. And you as the future need to know that. Now, I can't say that's what she was thinking, but I'm just saying that there is this, I think there is an idea that we could add here, that the idea of those children eating matzah was so that those children should taste freedom while still in slavery. And that they as the future should know that no matter what situation they find themselves in, they can still rebuild the Jewish people. You will rebuild the Jewish people. Because this is where we found ourselves in Mitzrayim. And this is what we came out of. And you too can come out of that and be eternal no matter what comes your way in the future. So perhaps that was something else that lied in that. Okay. Another thought I want to share with you is the following. You know, there's a pasuk in Devarim that describes the Jewish people going through Egypt as going through a Kor HaBarzel. A Kor HaBarzel is a smelting pot. When you put metal through a furnace, and it burns it, and it's meant to purify it, it's meant to extract extract the impurities and leave pure metal. That is what Mitzrayim is compared to. It extracted the bad and brought and left the good. Now the obvious question is, that doesn't seem what happened. It seems when we went to Egypt, we were on a better spiritual state. And we left Egypt, we're on the 49th level of impurity. So it doesn't seem like we became purified in Egypt. On the contrary, we became contaminated in Egypt, and we came out of that. So what's the comparison to a Kor HaBarzel? What was that smelting pot? What was that purification that we went through in Egypt when it seems that we didn't become pure in Egypt, we became more spiritually contaminated in Egypt? So Bishol Reisman has a very interesting explanation. And he starts with the fact that when Yaakov Avinu hears about Yosef is alive, and he and his children are going down to Mitzrayim, it says there that Yaakov brought shlamim. He brought a carbon shlamim. Carbon shlamim, we know there are different types of carbonis. It's a carbon oila, completely burned. Carbon shlamim is not completely burned. As a matter of fact, the kohen eats from the meat, the person who brings the carbon eats from the meat, he invites other people to eat from the meat. The carbon shlamim is something that part of it gets burnt, part of it we partake from. The Ramban comments that the first time a carbon shlamim was ever brought was this time that before Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, he brought a carbon shlamim. That was the first carbon shlamim ever offered. Until now, whoever brought carbonis, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Adam Arish, whoever it was, they brought an ola, a burnt offering. Completely burnt. The whole thing goes to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Yaakov Avinu now was the first one to bring a carbon shlamim. Why? Because Ramban says shlamim has the ability lahashlam elav kalamidus to basically bring together all attributes, as the Medrash says, as the Chachamim say. Why is this carbon called shlamim? Because shematim shalom ba'olam, it brings peace to the world. Shlamim, shalim, shalim goes together. Which I always thought means it brings peace because, you know, Hashem has something, we have something, but it's something more than that. As Ramban says, it's mashlim, it brings together all attributes. So what does that mean? What do you mean it brings together all attributes? So he explains from Rav Avigdor Miller Zatzal that the idea is like this. The idea is that we know that a non-Jew can bring a carbon. If a Gentile wants to bring a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash, he can bring a carbon. He can only bring a carbon oila. His carbon has to be completely burnt. He says, I want to bring a shlamin. No, you can only bring a carbon oila. Why is that? So Rabbi Miller explained like this, that in the eyes of the world, and it's something that we also have a struggle with, in the eyes of the world, if you want to be holy, so what do you got to do? Who's holy? What in the non-Jewish world, who's holy? Pope's holy, right? Why is he holy? He abstains, completely abstains. Okay, you know, if you're in India, you're a guru, you have the guru sitting on top of the mountain by himself, completely away from everything. He's holy. Okay, that means that by Gentiles. If you want to be holy, holy means you have to be separate. You have to abstain from the pleasures of the world. And that's what a carbon oila represents. Everything tasha. You want to be holy? Everything tasha. If you can't be so holy, all right. You can't be so holy. You know, not all of us can be holy, right? Right? Some people got to get married. They can't be so holy. You want to be holy? Can't be married. Can't be married. You want to be holy? No marriage? No. Just separate from everything. Klal Yisrael's tach purpose is actually to be mekadesh, to sanctify the mundane, which means that we do get married, we do partake, but we are supposed to be able to partake of the world and elevate it. We can be holy while being involved in the world. We can be married, we can eat, we can do things, but we have to do it in a way that it's channeled in the service of Hashem. And when that happens, we sanctify the mundane. We sanctify the physical. And that's what we need Torah to do. That's what Torah gives us the ability to do. But the purpose of Klal Yisrael is not for people to abstain and go to caves and mountains and separate from everything. We're supposed to have a life, a physical life, but a physical life that's sanctified. And through that, we sanctify the world. That's what the Jewish people are meant to do. That's what the shlamim represents. Shlamim represents the idea, I can partake from the meat, and I'm still partaking from a carbon. I'm still partaking from something that brings me closer to Hashem. Because the purpose, the ultimate is to sanctify the world. And that is what, that's the purpose, and that's what we are meant to do. That's the mission given to the Jewish people. Sanctify the world. Elevate the world. Be involved in the world, but sanctify it.
So what does it have to do with Joseph?
So, Ramban is saying, the Yaakov Avinu understood that now the Jewish people are going down to Egypt, the process is beginning. This process is starting. The process of now having to be involved, having to partake from the world and elevate it, it's starting now. So Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the Shvatim, they're like angels. They're malachim. Yeah, I mean, they're married. They're married. They have children. But they're on a very high level. They're on a very high level. They're on that level that says, you know, their holiness is about complete dedication to Hashem. Yes, we know that they had challenges. And we know that there were challenges that they were given. And challenges are always related to the physical. But at the end of the day, their holiness was more about abstaining. It's more about abstaining from the world and being completely dedicated to Hashem. And therefore their karbanos were all karban oila. Yaakov Avinu understood now the process of creating the Jewish people, which eventually the process of gaining the Torah, was a process now of being involved in the world and elevating it. And therefore brought a karban shlamim, because he's saying the process is starting. And my understanding of the process starting is the idea of that, again, you know, Avraham Avinu found himself in the land of Plishtim, Yitzchak in the land of Plishtim, and they had challenges there. They were Mitzrayim. Now Yaakov Avinu understood that when the Jewish people are going to go down to Mitzrayim and be there, right, they are now, Mitzrayim is decadence. Mitzrayim is the worst place to be, right? Mitzrayim is almost going to be a place where they have to. It's going to be impossible not to get more involved in the world. It's not going to be possible to stay on that level of abstention that they had before. But it was meant, though, that they should start that process of being more involved, but still remaining holy. It could very well be that the Jewish people, again, they went to Egypt and they got too Egyptian-like. That means they took it too far. Perhaps they were supposed to, again, it was inevitable that to some level they would become more physical, but not to the point of being Egyptian-like. The process of this being more involved in the world and elevating it was supposed to start then. So it's very possible that that we know that the Jewish people were, they sunk to idol worship and they sunk to different levels. And you wouldn't think that that's the kind of involvement in the world that Hashem wanted them to be in and elevate that. That's not what where they were supposed to be. But at the same time, with the fact that all that did happen shows that they were entering a situation, a more physical situation. And now going through that physical situation and now being taken out of it, you know what the purification process was? You know what the Kor HaBarzel did? You know what the purification era was? What was now going to be brought out of the Jew? What was now bring? What good? What attribute now was going to be brought out? What purification or what positive characteristic was now going to come out of the Jewish people when they left Egypt? This characteristic. This characteristic of becoming more physical, but being able to mekadesh that, sanctify that. And that could only happen in Egypt, where basically they were forced to become more physical. The situation called that they had to become more physical. It was almost impossible otherwise not to. Did they possibly fall too far? Perhaps they did fall too far. But they had to go into this state of physicality and emerge from that. And emerge from that. And actually experience the idea of being taken out of that. And now being brought to the Torah. Because now that they would had, and now they had that experience of being that physical, but now having all the miracles and having all the experience and coming to all that realization of Hashem with the purpose of receiving the Torah, now gave them that experience and ability to now take the physical and to sanctify it. So therefore, the Kor HaBarzel, the purification of the process of being Mitzrayim, was for them to already start being more physical, but taking that to a higher level. And that was an experience that they had to have in Mitzrayim to be able to become more physical and then eventually receive the Torah to go ahead and sanctify themselves and elevate all that. Wish you all a good night and a Chakashim v'Sameach.
Thank you very much.